is the First Time podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Hello, Catherine Collette.
Hi, Kate Mildenhall. How are you?
I'm a little bit tired, but what I really like is that we are both in our sweats today.
It's a sweats kind of a vibe, isn't it? Everything about it.
It is. The sunshine's helping. I have done, can I just be smug and say that, you know, I've been running around a bit, so I haven't been on my daily Pilates gym, but this morning I went for a swim and then I did Pilates, and that swim, I love a swim.
Outdoor pool, indoor pool?
Nah, not yet. Ours doesn't open till like, till term four, but I started dreaming of it while I was doing my laps. I was dreaming of the outdoor pool. What's yours? Yours hasn't been open for years, your pool.
I know. Yeah. Northcote Pool is being renovated, but I think it opens at the end of the year. I go to Brunswick Baths outdoor if I go for a swim, but I haven't been swimming a heap. I keep Googling ice baths, actually, which are very expensive. They're about like, the closest one to me is Mooney Ponds, and it's $45.
Can't you just do it in your own bath?
I know.
Oh, that's a lot of ice, I suppose. You could just get the one, like $5 from the servo, chuck it in the bath.
Well, I kind of like the idea of going somewhere to do it. But
you know, at one of the places I've done Pilates, they did it outside, like in the little area outside while we were doing Pilates in a blow-up pool, and you could just hear everybody kind of squealing.
Wow. That's actually not a bad idea, a little blow-up pool.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think I like using the $45 enough as a barrier. You know?
What's your, why did you start Googling? What are you looking for in the ice bath? Are you looking for, you know, brain health, just something new?
Well, I vaguely know that they're good for you, but the bay swims that I have been doing, I'm sort of down to one a fortnight, really. The feeling of having been freezing and warming up is a pretty glorious feeling.
Nothing better. That crazy solstice swim that I did out with Mum in the river. I mean, there weren't ice blocks in the river, but it felt like there could have been ice blocks in the river. And, yeah, standing in front of the fire as I got feeling back in my body was very, very nice. I haven't done it again, though, I must admit.
Watch this face. Maybe
watch this face. Yeah. Get in touch with us if you do ice baths.
That's right. Have you been on the road? Have you just flown in from somewhere new today?
I have. Not just today, but I have been in Adelaide this week. That was gloriously fun. I had been doing an event at Matilda Bookshop, which I hadn't been to before. So beautiful up in the Adelaide Hills, just the most glorious store. And that had been booked in with the beautiful Pip Williams, and Pip unfortunately was sick and couldn't do it. So Hannah Kent stepped in, as you do. So that was really, really lovely because I was remembering, I only knew like the day before, and Hannah's actually just started working at the store as a bookseller.
A few days amazing. A week.
Yeah, right. And but I was remembering that Hannah interviewed me when she was at Kill Your Darlings when Skylarking came out, and I remember it so clearly. It was at readings in Carlton, and I was so intimidated and terrified and just kind of
so unsure. She had obviously written Burial Rites. When did Burial Rites
out? Burial Rites came out a couple of years before, maybe 2015. I'm not entirely sure, but she was like my pinup girl, my historical fiction pinup girl. And I think, you know, she's so smart. I think in that interview at readings, there were words she said to me that I didn't even know what they meant. But she's just so divine. And so that was really, really lovely to do that event with her.
Did either of you mention that original
interview?
Yes. Oh, yeah. You did. That's
yeah, cute. She mentioned it. And of course, because I got to interview her for the podcast too, we talked about devotion. She's so interesting. She's got so many interesting projects going on, which is really fun. And before that, I'd been in Canberra for the Canberra Writers Festival, which I'd never been to before. New festival director in BJ Silcox this year. I think the biggest selling event, and I didn't quite make it in time to get to this one, was the Bluey guy. Joel, yeah, whatever his name is, who writes Bluey. Yeah.
Right.
Sellout event. He was talking, I think the framing of the event was how to do narrative in 7 minutes. And that was a full sellout and everyone was so excited about that.
Oh, it's so beloved.
So beloved. But I did get to do my general festival fairy thing and say hello to heaps of people and do great events and see, oh my goodness, one of the debut crew 2023 folks, Izzy Odeberg, who wrote Hard to Bear. I got to see Izzy Odeberg in conversation with Neela Janakiramanan, who wrote The Registrar a couple of years ago, and also with Gabrielle Jackson, who wrote a book about endo. And they were talking, and Izzy's book, of course, is Hard to Bear, and they were talking about medical misogyny and experiences of miscarriage. And it was sometimes you just see an event where all the speakers know their stuff so deeply and they're so passionate and the audience is so engaged. I could have listened to 2 hours of the conversation and so deeply compassionate and in tune with people asking questions. So for instance, at the end, someone was asking a question and it involved them talking a little bit about their experience of endo and not getting the medical care they needed. And at the end of the question and answer, Izzy just got down off stage and went and gave this person a hug. And that was the kind of feeling in the room. It was just such a fabulous conversation and so important. So Izzy's book, Hard to Bear, has gone up to the very top of my TBR pile. But yeah, great fun.
Do they record those sessions for the Canberra Writers Festival?
I'm not sure. I'm sure that some of them were recorded. I know that I was interviewed by Astrid Edwards from the Garrett podcast.
Oh, awesome.
And I know that that one was recorded for the Garrett. And I'm not sure. Check out the Canberra Writers Festival listeners and you can see that they might come up soon. I also got to speak to Paul Delgano about A Country of Eternal Light, his latest novel. And also Mirandi Riwo's new one, Sunbirds, which is not out until the end of August, but they had a special pre-release for Canberra Writers Festival. It's so good. It's so good. So that was a really fun conversation too.
So what was the theme of that? Are they very different books?
They are so different. And it was actually really funny because Paul, it was called The Lure of the Past. And Paul did go to great lengths in our email chat beforehand to say, my book's not really historical fiction. So we kind of just, worked around it. Right. But have you read Paul's?
No, I haven't. It's on my to-be-read pile, yeah, but so, maybe it needs a shuffle up, does it?
So it's so extraordinary. So A Country of Eternal Light is told from the point of view of Margaret Bryce, who is dead. And you get that right up from the start. So she is dead and she's revisiting moments from her own past and her daughters. She has twin daughters, Rachel and Eva. So she's revisiting moments from their past and her past, but also moments since she has died. So she's kind of like a ghostly presence, if that makes sense. And so because of that, there are sections that go back to the 40s and the 60s and the 70s.
Right.
It has a massive, this is not a spoiler because it's in all of the pressed up about it, there's a big twist in the book. So one of the things that was interesting is trying to do a festival conversation, a panel conversation, when the premise of a book has so much to do with the twist, but we totally got through it. And yeah, I look forward to talking to you about it when you have finished it. And Mirandi's book actually Morandi's book, Sunbirds, is set in the 40s in West Java. So it's a story about wartime in this particular area, and some different characters, a local woman, a Dutch pilot, and the story kind of incorporates an Australian connection as well. So beautifully written in very much Morandi style. But in that one too, there's a kind of an overarching plot mystery. Really good, really satisfying to both books as a reader, which I really enjoyed. But yeah, keep your eye out for Sunbirds, Morandi Rewo.
Well, off that. It is a weird thing trying not to, I'm just thinking about events that I have coming up, trying not to talk about twists.
Yeah.
Because ideally you would like have a room full of people who've read the book.
Exactly.
But I guess that's book clubs, isn't
that's
it?
That's what book clubs are for. And that's the delight, I reckon, in book clubs. Or maybe doing festival sessions, like once a book's been out for a while, but then your book has to have sold enough and been popular enough that you get the opportunity to do festival sessions, you know, that far down the track. But it is really satisfying. I know when I do school visits for Skylarking, that's really satisfying because we can talk about everything that happens and the kids want to know. And it's just, it's much easier as the author. You don't feel like you're trying to, you know, sell
dance
something
around.
As much. Yeah,
yes.
Or dance around.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't know how crime thriller people do it all the time. They must just have a special language about doing it. What have you been doing, Catherine Collette?
I have been doing a lot of morning pages, actually. Yeah, I'm back into morning pages. I read Natasha Lester had a newsletter. I don't know if you subscribe to her newsletter. It has a complicated name. Do you know the complicated name?
Bijou? Is it Bijou? Kiss in French? I just don't know how to say
it. Is that what it is?
I think so. Or maybe it's
right.
Not.
Bijou? No, that makes perfect sense.
Shay
that
will
makes
correct
a
us.
Lot of sense.
Shay can speak French. She'll correct us.
Yeah, such a lovely newsletter, a real behind the scenes of her writing and work. But she mentioned morning pages in it. So morning pages are the very popular concept in Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way. Basically, the idea is first thing in the morning, you hand write 3 pages. I cannot believe you've never done morning pages or The Artist's Way because it feels like it should be up your alley. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Natasha Lester in this newsletter says she's always had a barrier to doing morning pages because they have to be done first thing in the morning. She already gets up very early. So the idea of getting up a half hour earlier, which would then be the 5 o'clocks, is unappealing. But she decided to remove that as a barrier to doing them. And so I think she said she does them once the kids have gone to school.
Like okay,
it's
nice.
The first thing that she does, which it is hard to do them very first thing if you have kids and other things going on. So I've gotten back into morning pages. I love morning pages. I think they're great.
I have some questions.
I don't know why I like them so much.
Are you getting out? Like, I can just imagine that mine would be the kind of a litany of thoughts that go around my head when I wake up at 2 a.m. in the morning and I can't go back to sleep. Is that the kind of stuff you're
it
getting
is.
Out?
It
and
is.
And then how do you get past that?
There's a degree to which you do start doing a to-do list or what you're going to give your kids for lunch and that sort of stuff. But I think that it goes for long enough that you move in and out of that. So you do get to more meaningful things. But I think what's the most interesting about it is that thematically you start to track around the same.
That's interesting.
When you get to the gems just keep reappearing. And that's an interesting thing that you're kind of tapping. It feels like you're tapping into this subconscious something, be it like a story plot point or a desire or a whatever that is. It's that the resurgence of something.
Do you read them back?
No. I think what she says in the book is to put them to the side and then maybe go back and
That's interesting.
Maybe she says to look for the themes, but there is something about these themes that emerge that's exciting. And it just is a very accessible activity, far more accessible than The Artist's State, which is a concept that I really like, but I struggle to carve out time.
Yes, you were doing that. Didn't you go horse riding?
Well, I intended to go horse riding and I never went. I ended up going with Tilly for her birthday.
Oh, that's nice.
Which was fun. Yeah.
You know, one of the barriers for me for morning pages has always been that I can't, my handwriting is so difficult to understand. And so there is one level, even though I know it's not meant to be for work, there's one level where I'm like, well, I'm not doing 3 pages of writing for nothing if I can't understand what I've done. But I have recently, I've talked before about the amazing pen.
This is the pen.
Yeah. Like it's not that fancy. It's like
it's a very ordinary looking.
It's a
pen.
Uniball eye. Fine. Okay. We're not being sponsored by Uniball here. But so I've bought a box of these so that I can take them around and sign my books. But I also, because I was in Officeworks and one should never let a writer go in Officeworks, I also bought a bigger version. What size is that? A5? No.
I
think slightly bigger than that. Of my to-do notebooks, you know, my little to-do notebooks that I use and take everywhere. Well, I bought this version because I thought I'll chuck this in my suitcase so that while I'm out and about, if I get ideas for the new book, I can write them down like this. Anyway, I've switched over my to-do list into this book and it doesn't have lines, and that combined with the new pen is blowing my mind. I'm writing notes in here. There's interesting things happening in and around my to-do list because of the pen and because of the no lines. And I couldn't be happier.
No lines. That's revolutionary. Mm-hmm. The morning pages and a good pen is the good pen goes a long way.
Yeah.
But I would need lines for morning pages.
You know, I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast before and then we will move on. But when I was a baby teacher and I was doing teaching rounds, I was with some year 8 students in a suburb I won't name, but it was pretty tricky. And one of the boys in the class didn't want to do an activity and ended up, among other things, throwing a table across the room, which was fine. Didn't hit me, easy. But what I eventually...
It's a low threshold of like,
yeah,
didn't hit you.
Didn't hit me. What I eventually worked out was that he needed a blank piece of paper without lines because his handwriting was too big to fit between the lines, so he didn't want to do it. Problem, I mean, not all problems solved for him. There were some other problems, but that was revolutionary. So sometimes the lines can be a barrier.
Mm.
Blank paper all the way. Anyway, we got off track there.
Totally off track. I have 2 books to mention.
Go.
The first one is One Song by AJ Betts.
Ooh.
It is... Have you read this?
No, but it's on that pile over there.
It's on the pile. It is a YA book. So AJ Betts won the text prize with a book called Zach and Mia, I feel like quite a few years ago now. This book, One Song, it's so lovely. It's about a pretty newly formed band of 4 high school students. They lock themselves away over a weekend and they're writing a song to enter into the Triple J Unearthed High competition.
This.
So essentially a songwriting competition. It's so fun. It lets you live out that desire I feel like we all have around being in a band. It's got a bit of a Breakfast Club vibe. The 4 people in the band, they're not friends to begin with. They're a bit of an unlikely grouping of people. They really don't all get along. The plotting is absolute perfection. There's moments towards the end where you're like, oh, that was there all along. It's just so good. Highly, highly recommend One Song by AJ Betts. The other one is Beatrix and Fred by Emily Spurr. Have you read this one?
I haven't yet, but it's here. I love the cover.
The cover's beautiful,
and
actually.
I love how everyone keeps talking about it as being weird and experimental because, you know, I love that.
Like a moth to a flame. Mm-hmm. Emily's debut novel was A Million Things. That came out 2021. That is such a good book. I was so excited to read her second one. This is totally, totally different. It's definitely weird. It's an unlikely friendship story. I love an unlikely story. I feel like unlikely friendship is really just a polite way of saying one person doesn't actually want to be friends. But I like that kind of arc of the resistance to the friendship eroding. What's really cool about this book, though, is you have this lovely story of friendship between 2 people, but it's also a book that is chock-a-block full of ideas. It talks a lot about kind of what it means to be human, but in this sort of metaphoric, literal blending sense of if a person is a body and a brain and memories and hormones,
mm-hmm.
if you could take over someone else's body and brain and have all their memories, do you become them? Even if you have a sense of having been or having while you are someone else, like it's a bit of a like a brain twist kind of a book in a really, really good way. So highly recommend.
Ooh, Beatrix, I love that.
And Fred.
Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by HQ, and we are talking to Elise Esther Hurst about her debut novel, One Day We're All Going to Die. Elise Hurst is a playwright, writer, and storyteller. Her recent work for the stage includes Bright World at Theatreworks, The Mesh at Red Stitch, and The Sea Project at the Griffin Theatre in Sydney. The Sea Project was shortlisted for the Griffin Award. Elise's debut novel, One Day We Are All Going to Die, was published in August 2023. A second novel will follow in 12 months' time. Welcome, Elise.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure to be here. Second novel. That's good to know.
I know. I'm just joking. That's in your bio that a second novel will follow in 12 months' time.
Yes, I did not approve that. No, just joking. I know, but I didn't.
I did say this off air, but massive congrats on the book. It is so, so good. I normally have a system for reading books close to interviews, and I allocate 3 days, and I generally have to read 100 pages a day. I read yours in one. I even took it to the Barbie movie in case the Barbie movie was boring. That's how good it is.
Wow. Wow. Was the Barbie movie good?
It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. Have you seen it?
Okay, so I guess you didn't. No, it's on my list, but I'm guessing you didn't read my book during the movie then, which is fine.
You maybe I shouldn't have said that. Yeah. Okay, we're going to start with an elevator pitch. Tell us, what is the book about?
The book is about a young woman called Naomi. She's 27. She's Jewish. She lives in Melbourne. And she's just trying to be a normal person and live her life and date and, you know, fail terribly at life, all under the pressure of her parents and a Holocaust survivor grandmother, who dominate her life.
I'm going to come back to the pressure, but first, Naomi works as a curator at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. It feels like the perfect choice for her. What is it about curation that appeals to Naomi?
I guess she loves history. She loves, her family, and she feels the weight of the history of, you know, her family's experience and her people's experience as she moves through the world in day-to-day life. So I guess it's quite important to her to be, you know, tasked with the preservation of artifacts and of story. It is a really suitable place for her.
I think one of the funny things in the book is the way that Naomi works very, very hard on her job and the exhibitions that she does as part of her work, but her family can be quite casual in their critique of them. So, for example, Cookie, her grandmother, doesn't want to go to the Jewish pottery exhibition because it sounds boring.
Yeah, they're very, very dismissive of her line of work, or can be, yes.
I'm interested in this kind of play that you have, because it does feel like play at times, in how Jewishness is represented in that formal museum setting, in the kinds of exhibits that they have, versus how Jewish heritage and community is represented more broadly in the book. Mm. Do you see these as two different things?
Yeah, I guess so. I think, you know, for so many Jews, they experience that Jewishness in a multitude of ways. For Naomi and her family, it's much more cultural than it is religious or observant. And I guess for a lot of people, their Jewishness and that kind of cultural way of celebrating being Jewish is done through story, and it's done through ritual. But I guess, and especially for Cookie, she has this feeling that she doesn't really want to draw attention or so much attention to what it is to be Jewish. She doesn't maybe, and that's kind of a hang up from, you know, experiencing persecution herself, that, you know, she doesn't understand this obsession or need to kind of go on about it.
Mm. Oh, he's such a lovely character.
Mm. She is.
Family is really central to the book. Community is also really central to the book. At times there's a bit of a push-pull for Naomi, particularly in terms of family, and she definitely feels the pressure that you mentioned before and the weight of expectation. What are the expectations she takes on, and what are the expectations she pushes back against?
I guess she, you know, there is a great deal of pressure that especially, you know, this second and third generation Holocaust survivors feel to be successful in not just a few aspects of their life, but every aspect of their life. So that includes, you know, social life, work life, romantic life, and, you know, whether or not you have children, or, you know, all those decisions. There is an expectation, spoken or unspoken, to be successful and achieve greatness in all of those areas, because there's, you know, kind of brought up with this fragility, this inherent understanding that, you know, at any moment any of this could be taken away. That's kind of the that's what's implied. I don't know whether it's actually true, but this is kind of something that, you know, second and third generation descendants of Holocaust survivors have inherited. And it really is, you know, it is embedded in Naomi to be successful in her work life. She would like to be successful in her romantic life. And while she does really want that for herself, it's obviously not, it's not that easy to necessarily find the perfect Jewish doctor / lawyer / architect / whatever esteemed, you know, profession or identity you could come up with. And that's what Naomi struggles with, that she, you know, she has the goods. She's gorgeous. She's funny. She's accomplished. She's kind. She'll really date anyone or go home with anyone, you know, like, you know, kind of quite, you know, open-minded and, you know, wide open, has her eyes wide open. But just can't seem to, I don't know, be successful in that area of her life. And that is a real point of tension for her and her parents in particular.
Mm.
And I suppose for her parents' generation, I guess, you know, that generation, they got married very young. They weren't necessarily thinking, I don't know, I don't want to speak for that generation as a whole, but, you know, romance wasn't necessarily a priority. It may have been a prioritizing of, you know, financial stability, maybe getting out of a home that was, you know, their parents' home, which was a point of kind of a trauma or, you know, a means of escape. So whereas, you know, Naomi has kind of had everything handed to her on a silver platter, and meanwhile she just can't find that thing, that elusive relationship goal. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the relationships that Naomi has. I sort of have sad girl novels on the brain because I recently read Pip Finkmeyer's sad girl novel, and I was thinking a lot about sad girl novels for interviewing her for that. And I think there are elements of this book that feel like a sad girl novel, but then I don't really think it is a sad girl novel because Naomi's not sad enough. But an element of the sad girl novel is this apathetic or unsatisfying sex with men, and that's definitely something that Naomi experiences. You are great at writing sex, even when the sex is bad. Like, this is a really sort of sexy book, and that sounds like a really strange thing to say. How do you write good sex?
I think I write the sex I want to read.
Right, good answer.
I don't know if it's possible to be, well, at least, I mean, I said it in 2009. So, you know, it's not set in 2023, and I don't know what it is like to be 27 in 2023, but I do know what it's like to be 27 in 2009. And I don't know if it's possible to sleep with people and not have disappointing sexual experiences. So yes, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly in the book, but I think that's just trying to treat it with honesty, which can be extremely uncomfortable at times.
It does feel very honest. Continuing in this theme of writing, normally I ask this up front, but I completely forgot to. When did you know that you wanted to write this story, and how did you begin?
I decided to write it sitting in my therapist's office. It sounds very Jewish, this answer. It was like 3 weeks after my grandmother had died, and I was absolutely devastated. And she was almost 99. She was like 4 days from her 99th birthday. A very important figure in my life. And I was sitting there and inconsolable, but I felt so ridiculous because she was so old, and it wasn't like a young person dying anyway. We can all relate to this. And you know, in the midst of my, you know, crying and my therapist telling me like it's fine, and it is actually, regardless of, you know, how much you want to minimize it, losing anyone is a trauma, and losing your grandmother is mm-hmm. a trauma, and that's okay. So in the midst of me crying, and I was like, and I want to write a novel. Everyone around me is writing a novel, and I'm just sick of it. I just can't handle it. She's like, just write a novel then. So I was like, fine, I'll go and write a novel. That was the conversation.
Oh my God.
I mean, I would have to see if like she had notes to verify the truth of this, but this is what it is in my mind. So I kind of came out of there with a fire in my belly. And I, you know, and it kind of, that first scene in the book, which is between Naomi and her grandmother, has changed very little. It's, you know, it's one of those things where you just kind of, it's just in you. And I didn't really know what the novel was going, I didn't know where the novel would take me. I thought it was going to be a book about intermarriage and what it is to, you know, marry out in the context of the Jewish community, and what that experience, the impact that experience has on people and on family, and why it can be so fraught. That's what I thought I was going to be writing about. And then, you know, while there are elements of that in the book, it did take on a life of its own. And so just after I'd made that decision, I kind of gave myself little goalposts. One of the first ones was a conversation I had with a mum at school who is in the writing community, and I said, I think I just need a novel writing class, workshop, something. And she said, oh, you should go and do one of Anthony Yap's novel writing masterclasses. And have you, you've done one?
I have, too? Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I have like listened to like the whole backlog of first time podcast episodes. So I got in touch with Anthony, and for that workshop, you know, the expectation was you had 10,000 words of your novel. So I was like, right, 10,000 words. So that was kind of my first, my first kind of goalpost was to get those 10,000 words done, which I did in time for the workshop. And then after that, it was kind of just, I don't know. Yeah, that was my process. COVID happened. I got a lot of it done during lockdown.
Elise, in addition to being a novelist, you're also a playwright. In what ways did the novel writing mirror the playwriting process, and in what ways did it deviate?
I think when you're writing anything, apart from when you're, you know, in a co-writing situation, it is quite, you know, isolating, lonely. Lonely is not the right word, but it's just, what's the word? Solitary. That is what is similar. And the other parts that felt similar to me were when, you know, I finally got that structural edit and began working closely with my editor and then my copy editor. Because theatre is so collaborative, once you get from the page and then actually begin interacting, you know, with a director or a dramaturg and actors. So they were the points that felt similar, and I was really happy to be in that kind of collaborative mode once I got, you know, it's great if you have, you know, a great connection with your editor, and I did. Very, very fortunate there. And the parts that felt dissimilar, I guess I felt like writing a novel was way more expansive for me. I think because in theatre I've kind of become trained to write for companies that have limitations or expectations that, you know, you might only write a two-hander or a four-hander or something that's not going to have a large card size, it's not going to cost too much money, that, you know, the set will be feasible, that, you know, that all of kind of, yeah, I guess, constraints which you don't have with a novel, because you really can take your characters anywhere or do anything with them at no added cost. It sounds weird to think of it in those terms, but I found it really liberating. But, you know, I'm very comfortable sitting in dialogue and, you know, expressing character through talking. So I enjoyed that aspect of the book, and it is probably quite talk heavy. I don't know how you experienced it.
I didn't notice in kind of the very best of ways. I was too deep in
Maybe it isn't.
You mentioned your editor and structural edits and copy edits. How did you go about finding a publisher? How did that happen?
So I did this event for Melbourne Jewish Book Week. It was during a lockdown, because I remember it was a Zoom event. Yay,
Zoom event. Sad about them, isn't it?
Sorry. Sorry to bring the tone down. And I wrote a story, and, you know, and it was kind of a salon evening, and I read my story, and I'd put a bio with my, I'd sent my bio off, and at the end of the bio I put, Elise is currently writing her first novel. I'm just like, I'm just going to put it in there, see what happens. And amazingly, the MC who was coordinating this salon event, Ginger Gorman, who is also a writer, and she said to me, oh, you must tell me about your novel and when's it being published, and I can't wait to read it. And I was like, oh, well, yeah, funny you mentioned that. I actually haven't finished it yet, and I don't have a publisher or an agent or anything. And she said, actually, I know an agent who's looking for people. Would you like me to put you in touch? Fast forward.
That feels so manifesty.
It was perfect. And so she put me in touch with my agent, Sarah McKenzie, who is amazing. And kind of, what happened after that? I only had to send, 30 pages of the book. So in like the 24-hour, 48-hour period between me emailing with Sarah, I was, you know, rapidly editing those 30 pages, getting them really tight, and sent them off to Sarah. And she was like, thank you. You know, it might be a little while, I'm a bit backlogged, you know, until I can read and respond, but thank you. I was like, okay, I've got however long I've got to. Yeah. I think she said actually 6 weeks, she'd be able to read it in 6 weeks. I'm like, okay, I've got 6 weeks. I'm going to finish editing, because I did have a first draft, but, you know, really editing the hell out of this book. Amazingly, I have a neighbour who lives two doors down who I met at the park, who said she was really interested in getting into copy editing. She's a lawyer, but she was like, do you want me to copy edit your book for you? I was like, sure. Yes, please.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
So then she actually went through the whole novel. So as I was kind of collating her notes, collating stuff I'd had from a manuscript assessment, and just, yeah, spent that 6 weeks really fine-tuning the novel, or, you know, a draft of the novel. You know, it never ends up being like that. But and then 6 weeks later, got an email from Sarah saying, great, I really enjoyed the first 30 pages. I want to read more. I want to read the rest. I was like, yes, perfect. Here you go.
God. You make that sound so effortless. And
I do. I'm really sorry.
Yeah. There's a lot of effort that sits behind it. But what a wonderful series of events.
Yeah. So then she read it. I think it took about 2 weeks to get back to me. Had a whole heap of really amazing feedback and useful suggestions. And then her and I worked together for about 3 months, going back and forth, editing the book, and kind of at the end of those 3 months, she was like, great, I think it's ready to send to publishers. Here's a contract. You know, like basically, I guess, seeing if I had the goods before she signed me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I signed with Sarah, and yeah, then it happened very quickly after that. It's kind of, she sent out the pictures, and I had pretty swift response from three publishers, and I went with HQ, and yeah, the rest is history.
I never get tired of hearing people's publication stories. I have an insatiable
appetite.
It's like
birth stories, right?
It totally is. It totally, totally is.
Yeah.
Elise, yes. Most of our listeners are writers. What is either the best or the worst writing advice you've ever received?
A really useful piece of advice I got many years ago would have been in a theatre writing workshop. I'm pretty sure the teacher told us to go through our, you know, your script and just like cut all the dialogue in half. Just like happens if you go through it and just cut each sentence in half. And I think it was because, you know, we people more so have a tendency to overwrite, and just what effect that has. And I think I've really taken that with me, you know, to always cut the sentence off at the earliest possible moment, you know, just enough, when there's just enough.
Do you do that with all sentences, or you apply that mostly to dialogue?
I think I just have it in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, mostly with dialogue, but because we do speak in we don't often speak in complete sentences. Yeah, and just thinking about the impact that that has, and it might not necessarily work half the time or most of the time, but it is an interesting exercise. And another one I think I got from one of Anthony's workshops was about just work on making, I'm really going to massacre this piece of advice, but let the work like come into its own, be what it's meant to be. do you know what I mean? Yeah.
I do. I think sometimes we want it to be something else, you know?
Yeah. Like
certain way, but it can only be what it already is. Sort of, to me, feeds into that idea of a story already exists, that it's in the ether, you kind of have to find it. But maybe I'm just reinterpreting it in a different way.
No. Yeah, no, I find that just, yeah, I think the story already knows what it is, which is maybe what you just said. The story already knows what it is, and just let it be its best self, basically.
Mm.
Yeah.
Final question. Can you recommend, no pressure, a debut book? It can be any genre, any author, from any place.
I'm going to recommend Brown Press's The Book of Dirt, which I finished reading a few weeks ago, and I was so glad I did. I think we were talking about it before, just being this kind of incredible blending of docu-fiction. I especially love the appearance of a golem in the work, which, you know, is a Jewish mythical creature who is tasked with the responsibility of protecting Jewish people from anti-Semitism. And this golem appears in a concentration camp in Poland. And I just, it just destroyed me. It was just so wonderful. And I'll also plug my mum's book.
No, yes.
My mum wrote a book which is really moving called The Man Who Wasn't There, Searching for Gerhard, and by Susan Hurst. And she wrote it kind of trying to find answers about her own father who left when she was a baby. It's just an incredible document, which I don't know if you can actually go and buy, but I think you can borrow it from the Lamb Library in Caulfield. So
we will put a link in our show notes. Elise, do you have events coming up? Where can our listeners find you?
I have a book launch on the 19th of September at the Avenue Bookstore in Elsternwick, and I'll be chatting with the amazing Lee Kaufman.
It'd be brilliant.
So, yeah, I think you need to book, but details will be on my Instagram if you want to go there, find out how to come. Love to see you there.
I have some books that I want to mention. One of them I'm reading right now and I haven't finished it yet, so this is an in progress. One of the things that has, of course, happened while I've been visiting all the bookstores is that I've purchased a lot of books, but which I knew would happen, and that's fine. And what I love is basically going off the bookseller's recommendations, because there's been a whole lot of interesting books that I wouldn't have picked up that I've picked up. And so one that I got this week in Adelaide when I was at the very beautiful Imprints booksellers, and this is what Jason recommended, is a book called Valentine by Elizabeth Wetmore. And he recommended it because he said he basically loves anything that comes out of the Iowa Writers Workshop. Oh. And so this is a debut book. It's set in the 1970s in the US, somewhere down south. It's very gritty and dark kind of opening, but a revolving point of view. So I'm a third of the way into it, and I've already had maybe four or five different voices. Just very accomplished, very interesting.
And voices within the same world.
Yeah, same world, all kind of revolving around the same incident, which is an assault. Warning to people who don't want that kind of book. But yeah, really, really excited and interested just to be reading books that I would otherwise, they would not have been on my radar. I think it's a couple of years old already. I just wouldn't have picked it up. And there's one of the other piles in here now is all of the books that booksellers have recommended that I've picked up along the way. Another book that I've just finished, and interestingly, I just posted about this one on Instagram, and you know my philosophy is generally that I only post about books that I like on Instagram. Ooh, and again, disclaimer, well, I don't generally say negative things about the books I post about on Instagram. And a disclaimer, if I have not posted about your book, that doesn't mean that I don't like it. It just means that I haven't got to it yet. But I read The Ferryman by Justin Cronin. Did you read The Passage trilogy by Justin Cronin? Mm-hmm. Big US writer. The Passage came out, maybe 8 years ago. Huge bestseller, vampire type story. Adam and I both loved it, like ripped through them. Really interesting books. And I think the thing that I found really interesting at the time, and I think I'm getting this right, is that Cronin was a literary fiction writer, you know, published some books, interesting enough, kind of critical acclaim, didn't sell. And so he said, stuff it, I'm going to write a vampire trilogy, which went off its nuts and became a bestseller. So that's his background. This is his new one, The Ferryman. It's a dystopia. Starts really well. It's been really interesting. It's been my kind of like relax into read, which I know is weird for to have a dystopia as you relax into read, but it's, you know, a bit more commercially kind of easy reading. Interesting ideas, kind of a new world where everything is great, that then there's a twist and you work out that everything's not so great, but it lost its way for me. It became a little tedious. It's a very big book. It needed a little to be a bit less. And this other thing that really got me.
Love that.
Yeah, a little bit less.
It needed to be less.
Yeah. But, and I'm saying all this because Justin Cronin's, you know, New York Times bestseller, and he can cope with.
I'm criticism. Reading your Instagram review as you're speaking. I agree. Yeah. If you're a big selling author, you can cope.
Yeah. I didn't tag him. I mean, come on. Didn't tag him. But the other thing, and I don't know if this is just a very particular bugbear that I have right now that I'm being very sensitive about. But there's some language in there, the way he writes about women and a younger girl character, that's just
like a what? Bit like highly kind sexualized?
Of old or? Uncle. Nah, it's not highly sexualized. And this is why it might be very particular. Like, he refers to the child as honey. And the women are often described by the way they look. And it stood out to me. And I don't know whether that's just because other books aren't doing that so much anymore, or maybe I read books mostly by women. I'm not sure. But I was like, really, Cronin? Like, be better. Just be a bit better.
That's so old hat in some ways. It's like often raised as a thing, that thing of I think we have moved on from that, but that idea of like a male author describing,
yeah,
sometimes they parody it and they'll have do a description of males. Like,
it's quite subtle, and I can't give you better examples than you know, the reference to honey and some kind of ick, you know, physical descriptions. It felt a bit lazy. Felt a bit lazy. In those parts.
Beyond lazy, though, yeah.
Having said all that, criticism aside, what was really interesting to me is, you know, he's got big idea stuff. It's about, you know, late-stage capitalism. It's about the end of the world. He writes a kind of end-of-the-world apocalypse scene very well. He writes action very well. It will absolutely 100% be turned into a movie. There's a lot of stuff about workers' rights, which is my particular, you know, thing right now, which I thought was really interesting. But just, did he pull it off? Not entirely for me. So there's me. That is a new thing for the podcast, Kate being critical. Why don't you just do that while you've got a book out in the world, Milton? Oh, that's a good start. I have not been on Goodreads. I've just let you know. Haven't looked. Not going to look.
You know, have you set up a Google alert?
I took the Google alert off.
Yeah, I think that's a smart move.
I took the Google alert off after the last situation we found ourselves in. No more Google alerts. You can write anything you want about me, and if you don't tag me, I will not know.
As it should be, yeah.
What have you been listening to?
So I've got a short listening one. The Monthly have a new podcast called Read This. Michael Williams is the host, and he does interviews with different people. I'm not really sure what the framing is for it necessarily. I think it's about interviews with writers about specific books. Regardless, I think Michael Williams has a lovely manner and voice and just way of conversing with people that is so soothing and lovely to listen to. In the first episode, he goes to Helen Gardner's house and they talk mostly about her diaries. That's ace. In the second episode, he interviews Anna Funder about her new book, Wifedom. I am desperate to read that book. Mm-hmm. It's just a really nice podcast. I know, you know, obviously we are a podcast that interviews writers, but it feels like, I'm not 100% sure what its niche is, but it feels like it's carved out this sweet little niche. And I really enjoyed it. Read This.
I haven't. I haven't listened to the Annafunda one, but I listened to the Ghana one, and I also listened to the maybe it's the latest one with Christos Tsolkas. And same, I think Williams gets to kind of like the nub of the issue.
He's the kind of guy that if you were having a dinner party, not that anyone even has dinner parties, but if you were having a dinner party and you were like, oh, it's going to be a bit awkward, we'll just get Michael to come. And he would like, I feel like he would be a great presence at a table. Like he would, people would, a lot of people would talk to him and feel very like they had a special interaction, and he would be entertaining and all of these things on his own as well. Yeah, I really like him.
Excellent. I haven't listened to anything, but I have finally caught up on some watching that everyone told us to watch during lockdown and we didn't. And we are now watching as a family Ted Lasso.
Oh, it's so good.
It is so good. It is so good. It just, look at us both smiling, just talking about it. So we're only up to where maybe a couple of episodes into season two, and we decided that this was going to be, you know how you have rules in the house about who's allowed to watch what and go ahead in whatever season. So this is the four of us all together couch time. And like the end of season one, we were screaming, we were jumping up and down, we were like laughing out loud.
It's so good.
It's got all the feels. I'm so sorry it took me this long to get to it. And it is honestly, it's just so lovely. I love it.
It's really lovely. We have been doing as a family, but with my mum. So whenever if we stay at my mum's house for a night, we watch Ted Lasso and we're doing the third season. But the third season, it's like the first and the second season have this similar vibe. And I think it was always planned as a three season sort of a thing. But the third season just has taken a bit of a, I don't think the third season's as good.
Okay, right, we'll stop. We'll stop at the end of the second season.
No, you won't be able to. You won't be able to. I have heard that the third season pays off at the end. But also, weirdly, because the kids hadn't seen season one or season two, the third season just has an extraordinary amount of swearing in it, which both children are delighted by.
Yeah.
But it's left field.
Season two definitely does as well. That, like, Roy Kent, what a character. And, last night was when he first goes on television, and that was hilarious. I think, too, we watch we've talked about this before, where the other three members of my household are fairly sporty folks, and we watch a lot of sport movies. And this just, like, hits the spot for all of us at numerous levels. And, yeah, I'm loving it.
Yeah, that's ace.
What are you watching?
I can't remember if you've mentioned this one previously or not. Colin from Accounts. Have you watched Colin from Accounts?
No, I haven't. I may have mentioned it in the fact that my kids started watching it at Grandma and Grandpa's house just after the Logies, and then a couple of episodes in, obviously everyone realised it probably wasn't appropriate.
Entirely appropriate.
Yeah.
Well, it's so lovely. I thought it was going to be about Colin from Accounts, as in Colin would be an accountant, but Colin from Accounts, the dog in the TV series is called Colin, and they kind of joke that he's like a Colin from Accounts. It's such a lovely, lovely TV series. It's Australian. You can watch it on binge. There's one season and it's eight kind of half hour-ish episodes. The only reason I break it down like that is it feels essentially like a long movie. Like you can watch the whole thing pretty quickly.
That's nice.
Which is there's something really nice about that. But essentially you've got Gordon and Ash. Gordon's in his 40s. Ash is I think she turns 30 across the course of the series. They don't know each other, but they meet when Gordon is driving and accidentally hits a dog, and they both take the dog to the vet, and then they have to share this dog, looking after this dog. It's a romantic comedy. It's genuinely very funny. Even the peripheral characters are super, super strong. But the cool thing is, the show stands on its own as super cool. But the cool thing is that the two lead characters, the actors, not only wrote the whole thing, but are husband and wife in real life.
That's nice.
How good's that?
I like that.
Yeah.
What do you call it? A meet cute. Is that the meat cute?
Yeah, meat cute. Well, the meat cute's really good because, in fact, when they have this, and this happens pretty quickly, Gordon hits the car. But part of the reason he hits the car is for no reason. Ash, as she's walking across the road in front of the car, flashes her boob at him just for her own amusement. And then he ends up hitting this dog and then it sort of
unravels.
But, yeah, it's gold. It's very funny.
While you're saying that, it's making me think of the other funny rom-com with a funny meet-cute, which I loved, and maybe this was during rom-com, it's old, is Sharon Horgan's Catastrophe. Did you watch that? Did
no,
you tell
I
me
didn't.
To watch it?
No. Oh,
it's so funny. So it is Rob, who is I can't remember the actor's name. He's from the US. He comes to Ireland for a conference or something, has a one-night stand with Sharon's character and gets her pregnant. And so then they decide to have the baby together, but they don't know each other. It's very funny, very funny. There's many seasons of it. I've watched a couple of the, you know, the first one or two, and gosh, it's good. And that's when I fell in love with Sharon Horgan and have basically watched mm-hmm. everything she's ever done since. Including Bad Sisters, which you couldn't finish. Is that right?
No, it's too tense. Too, even as you were telling that story, I'm feeling the tension.
But you're not getting the payoff. You haven't got the payoff of that excellent series.
Well, no, I read the Wikipedia. Like I went, found out what happened that way. Very.
Oh, my goodness.
Safe environment.
We've missed Emily Spurr's launch by the time this goes to air, but what other things have you got coming up?
I have an event with Nick Bassine at Eltham Bookshop coming up on the Thursday, the 28th of September, so the tail end of school holidays.
Nice.
Very excited about that. And the other one is an event with Claire Fletcher at Robinson's at the Glen, which you just said is an amazing bookshop.
It is so amazing. Huge hats off to everybody at Robinson's the Glen. I'd never been there. It is so beautiful. It has a cafe, which also has a bar, which, you know, 10 points for that already. But Erica, who I'm not sure if Erica's the store manager, and the whole team there, beautiful displays, amazing events, and apparently lots of writers go there to write as well in the cafe. So, you know, you may spot a writer there. I'm so looking forward to reading Love Match. I haven't got to it yet, but I loved Five Bush Weddings so much.
Yep. So that's at the start of October, Friday.
The
6th of October. Yep.
Excellent. Very good.
Where will you be?
I'm going to be in lots of places. I am going to be at Heads and Tails Bookshop on the way down to Port Ferry. Yeah, Writers Festival, which is coming up. So Heads and Tails on Thursday, the 7th of September with our friend Mark Smith. So I'm really looking forward to that. And then Port Ferry Festival just looks terrific. Great lineup. Have a look at the tickets for that. I'm in conversation there with Hilary Harper about Hummingbird. So that will be exciting. And then another festival the next week, I'm going to ride around the Murray. Which I'm super excited about. So I've got a couple of events there. I'll be talking Hummingbird with Paul Delgano. I'll be talking AI and various things in that area with Grace Chan, whose book I loved, and also Tim Napper, who is an author new to me, but I think who won the Aurealis Award this year. So excited about talking to them. And then we're also doing a first-time podcast recording with Irma Gold, Tim Napper and Catherine Heyman about, you know, publishing experience and some of their advice. So
that's cool.
Super exciting. And this is the one, Catherine, where like, let's check back in where I'm taking one of my kids now, just one and two parents on tour with me. So we're going to ride around the Murray together. And then we are heading off on a little mini whirlwind tour around the southern part of New South Wales. So I've got four events. This is all up on my website. But if you are in the general localities of Burrawa, Huskisson, Maruya or Tathra, I'm going to be in all those places doing events.
That's cool.
Yeah. So very exciting. And after that, I'm going to have a big long sleep.
Yeah, you're going to fall in a heap.
No, I'm not going to fall in a heap, Catherine. I'm going to write a new book.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.